Let's give a big oceanfront round of welcome to Bill C.
Lou, you're leaving? I thought the chairman stayed up here with you. Thank you very much. I'm Bill Crawford, and I'm an alcoholic. And this is a thank y'all for staying. I was just talking to some people about being on Sunday mornings, and and I've done right many Sunday mornings. I'm the guy that, while they're moving the furniture and everything, packing up the room, I'm the guy who does that and right much. And I'm just grateful. This is just, this has been dynamite speakers. It's always tough on Sunday mornings because you just, you know, you're following such great speakers, and these have been great speakers. James kicked it off, and I had met James before, and it was nice to hear him talk, and just a wonderful kickoff talk. And Tim was a pleasant and great surprise for me. I never even heard of him, and he knocked my socks off. I'm on that. And then Paul and I go. Well, Paul and I have crossed paths before, and we've heard each other, and been on programs together, and we're friends and go back some years, but he's never been better than he was last night. And then there's what's her name. She had never been better. She, let me tell you something about Kay. There's some of us that don't mind getting some attention and this kind of thing, but Kay, most of the time, would rather take a beating than get up here. But she does it because she is devoted to her program and has learned not to say no to requests in the program. So anyway, it's just been a wonderful retreat. It's just great food, great people. I've seen so many old friends here. People come up to me I hadn't seen in years to tell me they're doing okay and that they're glad to see me, and this has been a wonderful experience too. You know, I feel so good. I don't know what to say except to tell you really why I'm here and why I'm at any AA meeting, any AA function. I always feel better, always do better, always see the people I love and like, and always am better from the experience. But fundamentally, underneath all that, the reason I'm at an AA meeting now, the reason I'll be at one tomorrow night, is because if I'm away from you for any period of time, I get in trouble with me. And if I know if I'm away from you for a longer period of time, I'm going to drink again. And if I drink again, I'm going to die. Now, I know that to some extent because of living in my own skin. And I know how wacky I get if I'm away from these meetings and away from you. I know that better from the lessons I have learned from the people who tried and get away from us. You know, if you run into somebody at the service station or the grocery store or something and you hadn't seen them in a while, you say, where have you been? He said, well, you know, I hadn't been to meetings in a while because I'm, you know, busy back with the family and trying to increase business back at the company or whatever, but I'm still okay. Still doing AA. Still praying. Yeah. Read the book. And people like it usually say, you know, by golly, I know if I need a meeting, I'll be there. If you ain't coming to meetings, you ain't in AA. Because we hear that definition read at every meeting. AA is a fellowship by definition. What we're about is what's happening here this morning. Now I'm going to talk, I got to be brief because I'm not checked out. That kind of scared me what Jay said. I don't know what they do. I don't think compound your luggage or something. To say I'm alcoholic, and so many of you heard this, but I've got so many people who heard this ad nauseum, and every once in a while you look down, you're talking, you see somebody's lips moving. You know that guy's heard it too many times. I to say I'm alcoholic, I know what that means. If you're new, maybe you don't know what that means yet. You learn. This is not only a recovery milieu here, a recovery experience. It's an education on our disorder. I believe, as the other speakers have mentioned, that this is a condition that makes me different from 90% of the people. Not 90% of the people in here, but 90% of the people out there. And I think sometimes when we come in new, we want to be different from these people, but we want to really think we're really like those people out there if we could just get it right. But I'm different from 9 in 10 people out there. I'm of the 10%. The experts say develop a relationship to the drug alcohol that's different, that causes trouble. And I know that from looking back with the eyes, the vision you've given me on my experience. I know that I'm alcoholic by the definition in the big book. And the big book goes into a lot of verbiage and a lot of effort to explain what's wrong with us. And I fit it to a T. And I think you do too, if you call yourself an alcoholic. Now, when we're new, we hear the differences, you know, and if you're new and you see an old geezer like me up here and you hear my story, we say, my God, I may have a little drinking problem, but I'm not like that. I'm not that bad. And the more we're here, the more we realize that we're so similar, it's uncanny. And when I talk about my experience, I know I'm talking about yours because of that unity we have, that commonality we have with this condition. I believe it's something we can't help. I don't believe I drink myself into alcoholism, as people sometimes say. I believe there's something different about me that made me relate different to alcohol from the very beginning. Now, I came up in a home, as many of you have heard me say, with a dual problem. We had alcoholism and Southern Baptism right in the... Right in the same man. And I often say, you know, once you got either one of those, you never get over it. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Once a Southern, once a Baptist, always a Baptist. Lou and I and Dennis worked for a fine man. He's still a fine man. I'm no longer working for him. By the name of Joe C. Many of you know he's an Episcopal priest. And I've said to Joe, I said, I know you're a priest, but you were raised Southern Baptist. It'll never get out of you. Call yourself Episcopalian all you want to. But if you're ever caught off guard, if somebody ever gets you up in the middle of the night for an emergency, you'll talk Southern Baptist. It's just, anyway. But anyway, what that means is my dad was the alcoholic, and what that meant was that as I came up, I had no positive image of beverage alcohol. I was taught from my experience, what I witnessed in my home, what I learned at church, what I heard in my community was all negative. And I knew that I would never drink. I knew that I would never be like daddy. I knew that I would never put myself and my family and through the embarrassment, humiliation, the uncertainties, the insecurities that go with active alcoholism. And then along came that thing we call peer pressure. And somebody asked me to talk a little bit about this. I was having trouble early, way before alcohol. In fact, alcohol in the beginning, like for most of us, was the solution. And I was having trouble adjusting. You know that part in the big book where it says we sought lower companionship? I was doing that in the second grade. I wasn't fitting in with the system. And I would determine I would. I didn't come along during the period of Ritalin. I came along during the era of paddling. And so they didn't give kids like me pills. They sent us a lot out in the hall, which was very embarrassing because I couldn't keep my mouth shut. I couldn't stay still. They didn't say, you're ADD or whatever, take this. They would say, get out in the hall. And I'd stand out there in the hall and be embarrassed when people would pass, because people would know why kids were out in the hall, and I would determine to do better, and I couldn't. And as time went on, I more and more sought my kind of people. And when I was about 14, 15 years old, I discovered cats. Now, you young people don't know what a cat is, but this is before hippies and all that stuff. The cats were the, some of you old guys know exactly what I'm talking about. But that's where we would comb the hair, slick back, and put that oil in our hair and ducktails and have the straight-up collar shirts and the draped pants with the snaps and the flaps on it and all the stuff and look tough. Go down to Manzo Henry drugstore and hang around. And I was a cat. Because the cats were kind of the rebels. And I would say this, my biggest problem then was a hair problem. I had a lot more hair than I do now. I mean, a lot more hair than I do now, but it was fine. In fact, I heard a lecture one time that, I don't know what's pulling me off of this, but a lecture where some expert was presenting his paper that he had done on ADD children. And he discovered all that ADD children had fine hair, and they later became alcoholics. And I wanted to stand up and applaud that guy. If I just had thicker hair. But what I did is I couldn't get that hair right. It would just, you know, I'd put all the wild root cream oil in there. That some of you kids don't know what wild root cream oil is. It's white. Kind of look like ranch dressing, and but it still would, you know. Sometimes just a whole clump of it would get out. And I wanted to be like them so bad. So one of my advisors in the cat world said, "Well, you get you some pomade." And pomade came in a can, and you could do that like shoe polish or something. Put on your hair problems were over. You know that Final Net commercial where they do with the gal goes all day and she has a real exhausting day, but the end of the day her hair's in place because of the Final Net. Pomade will hold your hair for a month and a half. I say if a train hit you. And they found your head, your hair with it. Anyway, that has nothing to do with anything except that this is the crowd that smoked the Lucky Strike cigarettes. This is the crowd that drank. Now, other substances were not available to us then, they were very limited. Some people took some speed and this kind of thing. The drug of accessibility was alcohol. And when, against my every thought of guilt and fear and everything that I resisted about that stuff because of my upbringing, I began to drink. I know that's called peer pressure now. I didn't know what that was then. It was to be like them, to be included. So no matter how bad I thought beverage alcohol was, to be tough, to be included was more important. And I began to drink. And I had me a little social drinking period there for a while. Looking back on it, and I've done some inventories, and I've sort of explored my history, I figure I was a social drinker for about 6 weeks. Because I'm going to take a half can of this or swallow that or whatever. But one night, and I was 15 and a half years old, one night I had ingested enough to know the feeling of intoxication. And anything like social drinking, anything like drinking with impunity was gone that night. I was, I guess, half an alcoholic. If we're physically allergic coupled with a mental obsession, then the mental obsession was there that night. There's a friend of mine that some of you have met. I know that Lou's met him by the name of Robert W., who describes it better than anybody that I've heard. when he was about the same age, he ingested enough alcohol to know intoxication. And he felt the muscles of his chest relax. And the significance of that was that he had never known until that moment that the muscles in his chest were tense and taut. I never knew that I didn't feel good. I didn't know just how bad it was, how fearful I felt, how apart from I felt, how not enough I felt until I got that stuff in me. That's the difference in me and that 90%. 10% of us get something special from it. Or as I like to say, 9 in 10 waste every drop they drink. Why they do it, I don't know. So I believe that it's what it does for us that gets us in trouble with this stuff, and it's what it does to us that hopefully brings us here. Brings us to this wonderful place of recovery or to some place where there's help. I'll give you, because I've got to get checked out of the room, I'm going to give you, I hope, a brief drunkalog, because mine is like yours. I love Dr. Silkworth's chapter in the Big Book. I love the way, because he is, you know, we laugh sometimes at these experts out here who study us and get grants to figure our disease out, and we sort of make fun of them, but by God, at least they're out there sober, and at least they can observe, and Silkworth was one of these guys. Now, he didn't set out to do a scientific study. He was just there on the firing line where thousands of us came through. And he just couldn't help but observe, as a scientist, as a medical man, he couldn't help but observe certain things about us. And one of the things he discovered is just what I've already said. These people are different. They're not just careless or stupid or uncaring. They're different. There's something about their makeup that's different. He said one thing these people have is a phenomenon of craving. It doesn't happen with ordinary people, those 90%. When they ingest a little bit of alcohol, a discomfort overcomes them. They get agitated, and they have to have more and more and more. Well, I knew about that in my teens. I can remember being down at Campbell College, and there was a particular night when everybody was having a good time. I can't even remember what the occasion was. A lot of people were drinking. Me and my bunch were broke as usual. We didn't have any money, and I wanted to drink. I'd already been drinking 2 or 3 or 4 years, and I already knew what alcohol would do. I already needed alcohol to be involved on a night like that, and I knew I needed it. And I desired a drink about as bad as I ever had up to that point. And at some point in that evening, somebody was there who produced a pint of alcohol, bourbon or something, and said, offered to pass it around to 5 or 6 of us. And at age 19, I turned it down. I already knew that if I took a drink or just a couple of drinks, I was going to feel worse. I already knew about the phenomenon of craving before I knew what the phenomenon of craving was. Symptom of alcoholism. These amnesia spells that we call blackout. Ordinary, that 90% don't get those. If you're wondering whether you are one or not, and you have these sort of periods of amnesia where you don't remember where and what and who, you won. Join up. Put a dollar on the plate next time it passes, you remember. Now, you want to experiment a little bit, you get one of these. You know, we're not the only people that can get drunk. Non-alcoholics can get drunk. Nothing more helpless than a non-alcoholic who's drunk. Nothing more dangerous out on the road than a non-alcoholic who's got a blood alcohol count of about a 0.07 on New Year's Eve, all over the road. Some of us in this room have been blowing a 32. Straight as an arrow. Practice. You know, we learn stuff. Like, Or if it's real bad, we'll learn to that and I head out the window. But we're not bouncing off those curbs. We might be driving in reverse or going 17 miles an hour. But we learn to not hit those ditches most of the time. Unless we doze off. I did that one time. Just sort of fell asleep, man. Just woke up bouncing all around inside the car. Car was knocking down signs and everything. But if I was awake, I could hold it. Blackouts are unique to our class. Symptoms of alcoholism. I had them when they first came out. I didn't know what they were. I thought I remembered everything. I'd get a report. I begin to lose control over the amount I drink. That's alcoholism. I don't have time to go into some examples of that, but I know I was set out to just drink a little bit. And I'd drink a lot. And I'd get in trouble. And I might end in jail, or I might end up in some other embarrassing predicament. I began to lose the control of my behavior. My personality changed in a way that was unpredictable. I didn't know how it was going to be. Now, all this was happening. Life was going on for me. You know, alcoholics do things that ordinary people do. One thing we do is get married. We will not leave people alone. I did. You know, we all do that. You know, that's how you get a family disease. You know, I've often said if alcoholics just go off in the woods and progress by himself, we can wipe this disease off the face of the earth. But we procreate and have children and mess their lives up, and that's what I did. I got married. I was in the Army. Some of you heard me talking about this. I've joined the Army. There's a time when I needed to get out of town, and I joined the Army and became a neuropsychiatric technician. I worked in the nut house for 2.5 years. And I just scared to death all the time. Scared every time I'd learn about some new mental illness, I'd have it. You know? That's the truth about alcoholism. It fits. If y'all know what's that DSM, the Diagnostic Service Manual that all the mental health people use, alcoholism fit every diagnosis in there, every symptom in there. And that's what I think. You know, they'd tell us about schizophrenia. So, my God, I've got that. Well, you can't let them know. I'm in there with my white suit and my keys, and I don't want to be switched over to those blue pajamas. But I would go, some magic would happen to me at the end of the day. I'd go to the club and begin to drink. And something wonderful would happen to me. And since we got some new faces in here, I'll talk about my little research that some of you have heard too many times. You know, they've spent zillions of dollars studying us. And I'm grateful they do. We have, I think, an illness. And many people call it a disease, and I think it deserves study. I don't see anything wrong with that. But I think it's because it's important, and I think it's because we mystify the non-alcoholic. But I think the non-alcoholic mystifies us. And not one dime, to my knowledge, has been spent on studying the non-alcoholic and how they drink. And so what I've done, y'all heard Kay yesterday, and she did a wonderful job. If you're going to look for a non-alcoholic, there's one. She's got terminal non-alcoholism. You can, next to the word in the dictionary should be her picture. She has non-alcoholism as bad as anybody you've ever seen. Well, time of 2 or 3 or 4 over the years, she's consumed enough alcohol to feel it. You know, a little buzz will hit her. You know what she does? She stops. Now that demands research. Can you imagine getting the pilot lit and stopping? And so somebody needed to look into that. So I said, why do you do that? And she said, because when I feel that feeling, I feel that I'm losing control. And I don't like that feeling, so I stop. The only semblance of control I ever had, when I believed that nut board, afraid they were going to find out I was just as crazy as the nuts I was supposed to be looking after, and I'd go to that club, and I would start to drink. The only semblance, the only thing like control that I had all that day would overcome me. That's the difference. They don't need to get any more rats drunk or study us anymore or whatever. That's all I need to know. There's something that we can't help, Kay and I. Something different about us that we have no control over that makes alcohol react completely different in her system than it does in mine. It's what alcohol did for me. I'd lose, as I said, the personality changes, the predictability of my behavior was gone. Alcoholism. I began that physical allergy works in a lot of ways. And one of the ways that it affected me and many of us is that withdrawal that we call hangovers. You know how you call those other things hangovers, and then you get those real ones when you cross that line and that real physical energy, and it makes you look back fondly on what you used to call hangovers. It's like the 90%. You know what they call it? They get hangovers on New Year's morning. I got a tough one last night. Really, I could barely eat my waffles this morning or something. And we know that ain't a hangover. And I went into the need to take more of that stuff in me when I would hit that withdrawal. And from that, I turned into a binge drinker, drinking around the clock. And by then, I'm married, I've got two children, and my life's falling apart, and their lives are falling apart. And anything about being a husband, anything about being a father, anything about being a good employee, anything about being a good citizen, anything about being part of any community was gone. And anything, anybody decent, anybody who was caring about living a good life was separate from me. And I was with those lower companions, and I was a pretty good lower companion myself. If you started hanging around with me, it was time to do something about your drinking. Lower companionship just means one thing. I had to go to the places and be with the people where my behavior and my drinking seemed all right. And I even started being asked to leave those places. That's pretty bad when you go to lower companion places and you can't even stay there. And I'm going to hurry up and get to Alcoholics Anonymous. In the middle of summer of 1966, I'm 28 years old, I was working for this crooked company. I had flown up to East St. Louis where they had an office, and I was supposed to be up there and be one of the managers in that office for a couple of weeks, and I was because somebody was out for a couple of weeks, and that was back when the reservist did summer camp, and he was out, and I stayed drunk for 2 weeks up there. And I flew back in, and by then I had learned to taper off because I was one of these binge drinkers, and I was tapering off when Kay picked me up at the airport's lounge. And a lot of times I would get on these drunks and just, I knew what it was like to quit drinking abruptly, and I would try to dose myself down and taper myself to detox myself is what I was trying to do. I'd never heard the term detox. Kay could never tell the difference between tapering off and drinking. It looks a lot alike to the untrained eye. I guess I explained that to her 100 times. No, I quit drinking yesterday. Today I'm just tapering off. But you can't blame her entirely, because there'd be a time or two I'd have a dosage problem. And I get drunk again, tapering off. And this was kind of one of those days. And she picked me up at the airport, and I was in the lounge drinking beer, tapering. And she brought me home, and somehow she and the kids left. And I did something that would be hard to explain outside a room like this. I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'd done all sorts of things up leading up to here about my drinking. I'd gone to a psychiatrist at one time. Gone to counseling with the marriage counseling with the minister. It was two against one. I dropped out of that. They get focused on my drinking and not her housekeeping. So, called Alcoholics Anonymous. And then it was this answering service, just answer service that answered for two oil companies and, you know, an accountant and Alcoholics Anonymous or whatever. And from that contact, a man by the name of Bill Norman, many of you know him, called me back. I just moved back to Greensboro a couple of years ago. I just retired and moved back to Greensboro a couple of years ago and had the privilege of picking Bill up at least once a week, sometimes twice a week, and taking him to a meeting. He was almost blind and almost deaf and not real ambulatory, but he and I would go to a meeting together, the man that brought the message to me. And we went to his funeral a couple of months ago, and I was so grateful. But anyway, Bill called me, and we chatted a while, and he's about as narrow-minded as about tapering off his K. He said something like, "Are you drinking?" Because he could sort of tell I was pretty glib there on the phone for a man who was desperate. Well, not really. I'm tapering off. And he didn't want to rush to my aid in that condition. But he told me who he was and how to reach him. Now, I probably had 100 reasons going through this committee head for making that call, and probably a lot of them were manipulative and dishonest. You know how we look for that sincere? Mental health counselors do that. They look for sincere, motivated alcoholics because they'll put on our charts, not motivated, dishonest. We all are. There's no such thing as a sincere, motivated alcoholic. Not for anything like recovery. I've had the privilege of calling on lots and lots of drunks because my sponsors were 12-stepping drunks. None of them ever met me at the door and said, "You got some steps I can start working?" It's always, you know, "You got any money?" Or "Take me and get me a shot." You know, "Call my boss." You know, "Find me a place to stay," or whatever. And so I was not sincere and motivated, but when she got home, I had the ammunition I needed. I had the man's name from the ANA and his phone number, so I could say, "Hush." I turned myself into AA, and he and I agree I'm not ready yet. But I'm going to call him, and I didn't call him. And I didn't call him, and I didn't call him. And some 2 months or 3 months or 4 months later, I don't know exactly when, she did. At a particularly bad time in our house, you know how bad it gets in our homes, she called this number. Now, Kay had been doing some things out there, too. She had been going around to some people. The secret was out. You know how these spouses of alcoholics are. They kind of try to hide us for a long time. But once they get to telling it, they'll just tell anybody. And so everybody knew it. So she'd been out getting help. But when she got Bill on the phone, she, for the first time, she had somebody that not only understood, but who had a solution. And he listened to her like we listen to families of alcoholics, loved ones of alcoholics. And he did the thing that I'm so glad he did, and she's so glad he did. He said, there's nothing we can do. There's no magic for him. But I've got a wife that goes to Al-Anon. You put her on the phone, and Kay every Wednesday night would go off to Al-Anon. And that was way back in 1967. They still call that group the Central AA Women's Auxiliary. But they were doing Al-Anon. Now, I believe that Al-Anon, by bringing some sort of recovery, the beginnings of recovery, the beginnings of God, the beginnings of a program into our house, had more to do with at least getting me to the door of Alcoholics Anonymous than anything else. Because without knowing it, without even understanding any part of it, I was seeing some health, recovery, something good happening in our house. The power of my disease began to lose its power over her. I often quote Ronnie Cates, a good man in Alcoholics Anonymous that I helped bury about 8 years ago, who used to say that when all else failed, when he was drunk and nobody was doing anything for him or giving him anything, he could play dead in the living room floor. And eventually Ruby, his wife, would come over and wonder what, even scare the kids, and the kids would, "Daddy, you know," and they would try to get some life out of him, and at least he could bring some sympathy and maybe a couple of dollars to him. Ruby joined Al-Anon, she could vacuum right around him. That's the difference. So it was on June the 2nd of 1967, which, thank God, through this moment is my sobriety date, we called Bill back. Bill knew about me. He knew about alcoholism anyway, but he had been lent a sympathetic ear to Kay, so he knew what was happening in our house and knew it was bad. And he said to me when I was on the phone that night, he said, "Are you about ready to throw in the towel now?" And I said, "I was, because I was." See, I'd run out of schemes and plans. I'd hit that wall. I didn't have any cons anymore. I didn't have any lies anymore. I didn't have any delay tactics. I didn't have any promises I could make that even I could believe. And I used to believe my promises. When I would sit out and get Kay to look over that horizon with me and say, I'll never do this again, I would believe that. And I'd tell that boss, "You don't have to worry. Rehire me this one more time. I will not lay out anymore because I'm drunk." And I would believe it. And I couldn't even believe it anymore. I was powerless over alcohol. We've heard that this weekend. Powerless over alcohol, if you knew what that means, is I couldn't drink. I don't mean I couldn't bend my elbow and swallow. I mean I couldn't drink. I couldn't drink with any kind of success. I couldn't drink without problems. I couldn't drink and stop. I couldn't drink without damage being done. I couldn't drink without hurting people. I couldn't drink with any predictability. But more important than that, and what we're celebrating in here, I could not drink. And so I went to Alcoholics Anonymous the next night. Kay and I went over and met Bill, and I felt just as conspicuous as you do if you're new in here. I felt like everybody was looking at me. You know how alcoholics are with us, you know, everything's about us, and I felt like everybody's studying me. The beauty about Alcoholics Anonymous or any bunch of alcoholics, Moose Club or whatever, nobody's paying attention to anybody but themselves, whether they're in AA or not, if they're alcoholic. You can walk in with two heads. Everybody's checking themselves out. I mean, yeah. But I didn't know that. And wonderful things happened to me. I never talk unless I talk about that meeting. Somebody, it was an open speaker meeting. Back then, most of the meetings in Greensboro, 11 meetings in Greensboro at that time, and all of them but two were speaker meetings. And some old boy got up to the podium like I do, I'm doing tonight, and told this morning, and told the story that we tell. That wonderful story. I never tire of it. I've heard thousands of times. I never tire of it. It's always that happy ending, you know. We know how it's going to come out. At least through that night. Tomorrow night, I'll go to a meeting, and some guy say, "I never made it. I'm drunk right now." But every talk I've heard so far has that nice ending, and the miracle is imparted once again. And I heard that. Not every word. I probably couldn't repeat it a sentence after he sat down, but I understood what he was saying. Miracle. That's a miracle. I'd been sober one day. I was sitting in the meeting detoxing. My attention span was that long, but I understood him. And more miraculous than that, I believed him. I believed every word he said. Had no reason to have any credibility with me. I'd quit believing in anything. I'd quit believing in do-gooders and groups, and I didn't even believe in God, I told myself. But I didn't have any other place to go. I don't know if you've ever got to that place or not. I hope not in your drinking. I know I had a job that I retired from just a couple of years ago, and I worked with new alcoholics and new in the program, and they'd have to fit AA in their schedule. Well, I got soccer practice on Wednesdays. They would have worked that out, you know. Not me. My nights were free. I had been kicked out for life from the Bamboo Lounge. Now, everybody in town, I hope, has got a Bamboo Lounge somewhere. It's where those people go that can't go anywhere else. I could not go back to the Bamboo Lounge. Now, if you can't go back to Bamboo Lounge, you don't need to check your calendar for free evenings. In fact, there's a couple other places I couldn't go back to, but that was sort of the dregs of the place. I went to a lot of AA. And I began to hear the experiences, and the winners surrounded me. You know, we hear stick with the winners. I hope people are still saying that, stick with the winners. That's the community of AA. That's the fellowship. Now, nobody, if you've been around here a week or two or three, nobody has to get, no old-timer like me has to get you off the side and say, he's a winner and she's a loser. She's a winner, he's a loser. You can tell who's got what you want and who had. It's clear who is succeeding in this program. It is clear who is not. And I knew. And these were guys that were committed to sobriety, and they did 12-step work. Back then, it was before treatment centers. We go out and call on drunks at bad places and bad neighborhoods and bad situations. And it always worked. We didn't get that sincere, motivated alcoholic much, but we came away from there a little bit more sober than when we went. And we went to the prisons and we went to the other halfway houses and the Christian homes for alcoholics and brought AA in there. And I was just doing it mainly because I wanted to be like them. I was doing it mainly because I was afraid I was going to get drunk. And I didn't want to get drunk because I knew these people had something that I wanted pretty much. At first meeting that I went to, those people, the joy that they, was in the eyes and that the countenance of sanity, I guess, that I saw. I didn't know what I was seeing. And they were eating that cake and drinking that coffee. AAs do. And, you know, there wasn't any cake and coffee at the Bamboo Lounge. And these people spitting cake crumbs out and whopping each other on the back and having the best time and offering me cake. And that's how you tell a newcomer. You offer something, you want some cake? And the guy goes, he's new. He hadn't eaten anything sweet in years. But you know, time goes, that body heals, that miraculous healing of the body. Before I know it, I was eating cake and spitting cake crumbs on somebody newer than me. And tell them to come drinking that coffee, and just like a real AA. And we're talking about those that sponsorship, that early sponsorship, got me to things like this. Not everybody goes to things like this, but by golly, these really saved me. Because I believe this is where the creme de la creme comes. This is where the people who really want that extra boost of program come. And I went to the retreats, I went to the conferences, I went to the conventions, I went to the roundups. You see people like me and say, how in the world did that guy get up at that podium and just be a convention speaker? Isn't that grand? Hell, and then an hour one. Stay scared to death all the time. The program began to work in my life through the fellowship first. Somebody couldn't have sent me a set of steps and a book and said, work these and then come on and join us. I had to have you first. This to rub off on me. This, the power of example. In the way you behaved, in the way you looked, the way you were. And I wanted to be like what I saw. And the only way I knew to do that was emulate your actions. And that's what people do. We act our way into getting right here. We don't think our way into that. I was powerless over alcohol. I couldn't drink and I couldn't not drink. I came to believe. Some of you heard me. I'm going to sit down here in about 5 minutes. I remember Bill told me right off, said, I want you to go to all these meetings, but don't go to the Sunday night discussion meeting. There's a couple of screwballs up there that will confuse you. Stay away from there. It was the only meeting in town on Sunday. He said, I'm going to give you that night off. I couldn't wait. So I went up and I was an agnostic. And I was just new enough to want to run my mouth. So it became a three screwball meeting. And I knew who the other two guys were. In fact, I was just talking to some guy, some old timers about them. I'm wondering what one of them we know had died and what had happened to the other one. But not everybody in that meeting was a screwball. And they would say in that meeting, and they'd get me over the side afterwards, and they would say things like, I was just like you. And I began to pray. I began to pray just a little bit. Whether I believed it or not, I began to pray. And when that worked, whether it was coincidence or otherwise, I thought I would say thank you at night, and I didn't want to get drunk in the worst way. And so in the morning, I would say, let me be sober today. And that night, I would say thank you. Didn't say it out loud. I didn't want any of my old buddies to know I was praying, but I was praying. And then things began to happen. I began to come to believe. And I took that risk that we take when we turn ourselves over to God and do those things that you've heard this weekend. You know, I didn't think I had any resentments when I came into AA. And then when I started writing, I realized I hated everybody. Everybody I knew, I hated. That's alcoholism. You know. Yeah, that's right. You know, yeah. Mother Teresa, yeah, that, yeah. Yeah. It ain't a difference. And I was able to sit down with somebody and tell that life story. God, we have that fear about that. Boy, we dream. Somebody gets up to the podium or in that meeting and start talking about the fifth step. I can't do that. Some things I can't tell. I say, take your fifth step with a trusted member of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're shock proof. And no. Or they'll never admit it. You know, say anything. And I say, as a test, just make up something. Make up the worst thing you can. Test it. Test it on your home group. Stand around the coffee pot. Just think of the worst thing you can think of. Get about five or six of them together and say, I ate a live rat one time. Nobody will flinch. They'll nod. One of them said, I used to do that. Isn't that wonderful? There's no secrets here. No secrets here. I got a sponsor. I sponsor right many people, but more important than that, I got a sponsor. I feel sorry for him sometimes. But he's the one that knows it all. Somebody in my life has to. Once I know all these things, then I can be prayerful, committed to be being rid of them with God's help, these manifestations of self, and clearing up that wreckage of the past. You know, it's a wonderful thing when we do these amends. They called it Humble Oil, now Exxon, but that was back during the good credit card days. I don't know if y'all remember the good credit card days. That's poor computers. You run with a credit card a long time before they catch you. And I'd run up a big bill, several of them. And I knew about amends. I said, well, I'll just call Exxon and tell them I'm sorry. No, you got to pay them. And I began to do things like that. And the beauty of that is that when the phone rang, I could answer it. And when I walk down the side of any street, I don't have to change sides no matter who's coming. That's the beauty of that. Now I am as committed to AA as ever. I've got more to lose. AA is more valuable to me. I do the things I believe that make me part of you, make me a member in good standing most days. What this all culminates to, I believe, what this all makes for us as members of AA. What real change happened to me? What I'm doing all this for? Now, I may be motivated to do these things that are strange and different and uncomfortable to me because I want to be sober and I want to be like you. That may be my motivation. But I find out later, what's the real purpose of doing all these things? Being with you and saying yes to AA requests and working these funny steps and all this stuff. It's to take what I have and to give it to someone else. And I find myself way early doing that with somebody who's hurting worse than me, more afraid than me, newer than me maybe. And I'm giving him myself as best I can. And a strange and new and good feeling overcomes me. And I look back on it and I realize that just for a couple of seconds I cared more about someone else than it did me. That's the reward of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just for a couple of seconds, I got relief from me. I didn't get selfish after I started drinking. Drinking gave me some relief from the pains of selfishness. And I had that feeling a little bit more the next time and a little bit more the next time. Now I can have that feeling anytime I need it, anytime I want it. It's to be as generous with me and my experience as possible. And I'm going to feel good and on purpose. And a part of you. And being a part of you has been the most important, rewarding thing of my life. And for that, I thank you. God bless. They don't have me a gift.